I nominate David.
Okay. All right. Well, this will be my first time to moderate a panel, so this will be interesting.
Yay.
Yeah. I'm a panel virgin, I guess.
They lose their innocence so early these days.
Yeah, great.
How not to be a panel moderator. Okay.
The original moderator's not here, apparently. So so first, we'll introduce ourselves, right? I'll let Ilanka start, and then I'll end up.
Hi, I'm Ilanka Dunnan. I've been in the game industry for about 20 years. I'm also currently in charge of the intern program at Simutronic, so I've read many, many resumes and cover letters, and I have lots of stories on which ones will make me go, okay, maybe, and no, you know. So it's usually about a 90% no rate. So I have some pretty good stories there.
Okay. My name is Brian Green. I write the blog at psychotraw.org. I have a helpful page on breaking into the industry. I'm going to basically just tell you how to do the opposite of that. I've worked in the industry since 98. I worked on an MMO called Meridian 59. I'm currently working on with a startup on a project called Storybricks. I've basically worked mostly on the independent side of things, so a lot of people kind of see independent development as their way to get a job at a bigger company. I'll tell you why that's not a good idea, and other helpful tips.
I'm Blake Sorensen. I'm a patent attorney and a general intellectual property attorney. I have also done my time as a game developer working for her.
He was awesome.
So I'm trying to get another job with her. I've helped a number of game companies go through the incorporation and startup process and watched most of them crash and burn, thankfully not because of anything I did, but usually because they didn't follow my advice. That said, I'm a lawyer. Everything I say comes with a disclaimer. Nothing I'm giving you today constitutes legal advice or creates any kind of attorney-client relationship.
Okay, got it.
Can't we give you a dollar or something to, like, take you on as our attorney?
No, I'm much more expensive than that.
Okay, gotcha. So I'll wrap up. I'm David Godwin. I'm CEO of Sneaky Games. We make social games on Facebook, and so it's a little bit different than the hardcore game industry, but it's a decent place to be, and it's a good industry to be in. And I've been doing games since 2003. I'm a techie from background, programmer. I've been programming and hacking apart games and stuff since I was like 9 years old. I'm 39 now, so that's me. So let's start off by first just kind of a general raise of hands. Is anyone in the game industry in this audience? Yeah? Okay. So who? And I'm assuming everyone else wants to be in the game industry or has a desire. Raise your hand, right? Yeah. So this is a great crowd that we've got today. So I don't even know where to start. Where should we?
Well, the two that are in the game industry, what do you do?
I worked at Sony during DC Universe Online, and then now working at Zynga.
Zynga is absorbing all right now. Yeah. Zynga does. We have another panel later on social gaming, but Zynga is a rapidly growing company right now. Does Yeovil and Cityville and Frontierville and
what town
Farmville.
Do you work in? What town?
Austin.
Austin. Okay. Cool. That's where we're based. So.
Okay. Your artist.
Send me your resume.
Yeah. We'll talk. And you're a coder, artist. What are you?
I was QA and design at Sony, and I'm back to QA right now.
I'd say
it's a tough market.
Okay.
All right.
And behind you?
I'm a 3D artist doing augmented reality for education.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay. All right. Was there anyone else who was in the game industry?
Yeah, I work with David at CBA.
Okay.
All kinds of programming, some design, and whatever else you need done for a small company.
Okay. So,
John's an Uber programmer, so.
Okay. Oh, we should probably repeat for the mic. So we have one person who is working at Zynga now, doing design, and was at. I'm sorry. Where were you?
Sony doing design for DCUI.
Okay, so design for DC Online, and 3D artist, and a coder from Sneaky Games, and I think that covers people. Another question is: those of you that want to get in the industry, generally they're. What people want to do, there's certain large categories. There's people that want to be artists, people that want to be coders, people that want to be designers, and then there's other parts of the game industry, absolutely, business side and QA and customer service, but going those core, how many people here want to get in the game industry because you want to be a designer? Okay.
Oh, do we have bad news for you?
And how many want to be artists? Okay, and how many want to be coders? Wow. Okay. All right. That's interesting.
Quick question. What do you call a designer? What define what a designer does?
Quick question. Define what a designer does versus a coder.
A designer.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, I think what the longest question was, who wants to be a game designer? Was the original right. role? There's mm-hmm. there's clearly
a lot of overlap.
Architecture and design on a game itself. That there's technical nature or design, and then there's the actual game design, the mechanics, systems design, creative design. And so, I mean, for me at least, we have two types of personalities that do game design. There's systems design, which are number crunchers. They know how to do Excel spreadsheets and really do level curves and all that stuff. And then there's creative designers, which help write the story, come up with the concept and okay. all that good stuff.
And I thought I saw Erin Hoffman. Did you just come up here?
Oh, hey, Erin.
she's on the board of the International Game Developers Association. She's a designer, senior designer. Is that what you?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and
unofficially here,
yeah, and she just wrote a book. So get up here.
You're official now.
Yeah.
We need another chair for Erin.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So let's give a round of applause for Erin coming up.
And this is what you can look forward to: being drafted on the panels like DragonCon if you work in the industry. So.
So hey, on the design question, what was that? Did that answer your question? Okay, good deal. So I want to ask again, like, who wants to end up being a game designer in the audience? Like, not who wants to be one right off the bat, but who wants to end up being there? Yeah. Okay. It's very common for people, and that's a good way to get into. It's really hard to go in as an entry level game designer. Usually, you got to go in through QA or project management, producing,
customer service,
development,
programming,
art. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. Generally, there aren't a lot of entry positions for senior game designers. It tends not to happen. I don't know anyone that was hired that way. Everyone had to kind of work their way up and pay their dues in some other parts of the company. Though there are people continually who apply and say, I need to design your next game. And I'm like, okay, well, what have you designed anything? Well, no, but I know that I can design your next game.
Well, so there's tip number one, how not to get the game. Come up and say, I must design a game. I have no previous experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Dungeons & Dragons modules that you self-design, those don't count. I mean, so.
It depends. Well, it depends, you know. If that's what we're looking for, maybe we will run into that. But yeah. In general, you need to, you know, in general, you want to, it's kind of the catch-22 of the industry. You need experience in order to get a job. Okay, you need the job to get experience. So how do you get that experience? So coming in and you know, thinking you're the next Will Wright, you don't need to pay your dues, you know, you're better than that. Yeah, that's going to get you kind of that 90% no list. Another great way to do, to not get in the industry, come up and tell me that my game sucks and you can do so much better.
Right.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of that. Oh, you worked on Murder for 9. That game sucked. Well, thank you for telling me that. No, please. Let's continue this. Yeah, let's continue this interview, shall we?
Yeah, I get an email from someone says, I really want to get in the game industry and I really want to work for some other company,
right.
Electronic Arts, BioWare, but they're too far away, so you're like my fifth choice and I figure I'd write to you.
Sure. No. Oh. Well, you sell yourself like that. Sure.
Whoever has the microphone. Okay.
You were talking about entry, like getting into the industry, like with design, entry level design. If you already have published work, and like, does that count? Like, you have books published. Does that count as experience that you can write for games, or do you need to like work with students that are making games to show that you've had experience in writing games in that way? Like, what's a good like resume like thing to have?
It really depends on the company that you're applying for, but it's always good, always, always, always good on your resume to show that if you want to be in the game industry, that you have made games.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best ways to do that is, like, just as you mentioned, with students. There's something called the Game Jam, the Global Game Jam, which I'm going to be plugging. I'm actually giving a talk about it here on Monday, which is a single weekend when teams all over the world of everybody, amateur, professional, anybody who wants can show up. And on one weekend, they're all given a theme, and they make games on that one weekend. So at the January 2011 event, we had teams in 44 different countries around the world, several thousand people, churned out over 1,500 games in one weekend. And it's an amazing, life-changing experience because it's so much fun to be involved with that creative process. And plus, once you make a game, even if it's in that game jam process, it's something that goes on your resume. It becomes part of your body of work, and it can stay with you forever. You can say, I made these games in the game jam. And there are games that have come from game jams that have turned into commercial products. And some of the biggest games out there right now started as student project. Portal, for example, is one of the big ones. Other games started as a four-day, World of Goo started as like just a four-day prototype and turned into this massive, massive game.
Speaking, specifically to the writing, it's funny. My first fantasy novel actually just came out last year from Pyre. I have it here. We're at the Pyre booth. Come say hi.
I have a copy of an autograph before you leave. Okay.
We keep trying. We keep missing that. But, it's interesting because I've been in the industry for about 12 years, and people that are in the industry, when I have this book, they go, "Whoa, you wrote a book? What?" They find it weird. Like it's strange and weird and interesting and cool, but it wouldn't have gotten me a job. Right. The industry has also gotten very separated by genre. So this counts a lot if I'm making a fantasy game, but it's not going to count for anything if I'm making a horror game, a science fiction game, other things like that. So that's another thing is I worked at First Playable for a couple of years, and we make children's games. Like our websites, we made a Dora the Explorer game. I worked on a Cabbage Patch game. It's the stuff that you do. And we incessantly got portfolios from artists that were full of like horror.
Space Marines. Tons and tons of Space Marines.
Exactly.
Space Marines everywhere. Yes, we know you like Space Marines. Thank you. Do you have any other depth?
Right, and this is an awesome X-rated fantasy chick, but it's not what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And you talk flowers.
Right. How not to get in the game industry. Don't do your research. Send your Space Marine portfolio to the kids game. You're not going to get hired.
But I will say on the writing front, I mean, if you come in as a QA or project manager, junior assistant producer, whatever entry-level position you can get in space, and you have writing, especially in an independent studio, when we're like all wearing a million hats, if we know that someone has writing experience, we're a lot more likely to let them kind of spread their wings a little bit and do some writing in addition to their job role to help get the game out or do some editing, whatever. And so it's a valuable skill to definitely have. It may not get you in the door, but it's definitely something that can help you move up and get into a position that you really want.
For anyone getting in the game industry, I would say make sure you have a website with samples of your work, especially that goes triple if you're an artist. Yeah. Any artist who's applying for work that doesn't have a website, that's going to be like an instant no, because if you're not proud enough of your work to have a website, if you're not together enough to have a website, then probably you're not going to survive in the game industry, which means that we may be missing some people with great talent, but you really have to have a website. And as a writer, I would say make a website, put samples of your work there, and make it really easy for a recruiter or a hiring person to surf. Because just like Aaron said, you might be a great horror writer, but they want to see, can you write for kids stuff? And so you might want to have on your website, here are writing samples, here's horror, here's children, here's fantasy, here's leprechauns or whatever. And so someone can just have that 2 minutes to go in and look and say, okay, this person can write. And usually I can tell if someone can write or not just from their cover letter. I've had people send cover letters where they say, I've always wanted to work for, and then they misspell the name of my company right there. So that's, and then they say, and they want to get a QA position, a quality assurance, a proofreading position, and they've already put typos in their cover letter. So that's another incident.
That's a good rule number three, is to have a good resume. Don't put misspellings in your cover letter, all the typical business stuff.
Don't misspell a company name, especially.
Right.
Exactly. So.
Just quickly, what qualities you look for, what qualifications you look for coders?
For us, we have a test that we send out, and it's a really hard test, and it covers several different languages. It might be everything from SQL stuff to Ruby to C++, and there will be some basic logic questions, some questions about terminology in computers and computer languages, and we don't expect any person. I've taken that test, and I've sent it to some of the brightest hackers and computer people I know, and no one has been able to answer 100% of the test. But when we get the test back, we're going to have a pretty good idea of what someone's skill set is. And we'll say, and also, it's an open book test, So some of the questions are going to be the kind of things that you could figure out really easy by just going to Wikipedia or going to Google and searching it. But if someone sends back the test and they didn't answer that question, which means they didn't take the time to Google the answer, that's going to be an instant no.
Right.
Because it was in the game industry, often we're inventing new technology as we go. And so we're always on that bleeding edge. So if we hand something to a coder and the coder says, I don't know how to do that, we'll say, okay, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, learn. Yeah, that's, I mean, basically, you know, most large companies are going to be looking at a test for smaller companies, basically just showing that you have the capability. You know, something I would like, something I kind of like is that if you have multiple languages, you know, if you know C++ and you only know C++, if we want to embed a scripting language in and say we want to use Python, and you're not willing to learn it, that's kind of a turnoff. So that's definitely something to be said for focusing, for specializing. But the games industry, yeah, especially when you start talking smaller companies, there's no room for specialists. You know, I'm exactly as he said. You know, when you're a small company, you're looking for people who can do a little bit of everything. And you know, there's no room even for, you know, you don't just have to be a programmer. You have to probably do some QA, your own QA. Maybe, you know, hop on the forums and do a little community management, you know, when you have the time. So, you know, the more you can do and the more you can do well, the better.
How about people who would like to work as contractors or sell tools to the game industry? Like a better way to patch your online game when people log in, or a ban system or something like that? How would you recommend getting into that kind of role?
I mean, that sounds like more of a business development type question. If you want to sell tools to like game companies, I mean, just as a way to reach out to the right people within game studios, LinkedIn's a great way. Going to the area of events, your IGDA meetups and all that good stuff. But it's about networking in game industry and getting into other studios. It's all about, you know, just getting to know people through events and reaching out to them and stuff.
Right. Generally, if you want to contract in the game industry, the first step is to get a job in the game industry and then leave, and then you can contract.
Yeah.
It's like this gentleman said, you know, the market's brutal right now for game developers. So I mean, you know, if I'm looking at somebody that has previous game experience and somebody who wants to do contract, you know, if I have a contract position, I'm probably gonna go with the person that has more experience. If the wages are anywhere near each other, so it's kind of a hard sell. The other thing about, like, with tools and whatnot is that the game industry is completely, yeah, I mean, a lot of places have kind of the whole not invented here mindset. You know, even though the programmers will swear up and down they don't mind that, every tool will not somehow not pass muster with them. So it's going to be a hard sell if, you know, say you have some middleware that can be used effectively, because game programmers tend to be really scary smart people. Kind of the faint-hearted kind of get weeded out pretty quickly. I mean, like Alonka said, you know, Sumatronics has a brutal test. They weed out the posers and wannabes. So the people working there are going to be really bright. The chances that, you know, so their mindset is going to be the chances that you have something that they haven't thought about, probably very small.
Yeah, and I'll agree with what Brian said about it's a hard sell to be selling tools to a game company, because it's a hassle. Generally, things are moving so fast, and someone comes along and they say, oh, we want you to use the tool, and then you have to deal with the contract for the tool, and then you have to figure out what's the ongoing maintenance for the tool. Are they going to want some sort of a monthly, you know, maintenance contract for that, which can be a great deal for whoever's making the tool, but the game company may just not want it. It may not be worth it. It's cheaper to just have a coder to just do it, rather than paying someone else to do it. Then again, some companies, they get large enough and they love that kind of stuff. They love contracting things out so they can just focus on making games instead of making all the tools that go around with making games. So it's really who you're dealing with. I make a website, you know, have a website, show the tools on the website, and then as soon as you get a contract with one person, really push that.
Right,
because
yeah.
If you get a contract with a famous company, then that can really increase your visibility for everyone else.
I think the other thing too is, you know, if you do decide to try to do middleware or sell tools or whatnot, show that you're in it for the long term. I was just in a panel with Linda Carlson from Sony Online. She talked about how they were talking about outsourcing. She talked about how they had a database product that had a bug in it that only affected a small fraction of people, and so the database provider had no interest in supporting them. I mean, that's kind of one that's the other danger you have. You know, if you're not, you know, especially a lot of small tool providers, if you look like a fly by night operation that you're not going to be around in a month if you don't, you know, sell 50,000 of your tools, people are not going to want to take the chance.
They're gonna develop internally, so they know they have control over it. So you know, basically do whatever you can to show that you are in it for long term. You know, maybe even do like code escrow or something like that. You know, in the event that we're no longer able to support it, you know, you get full source code or something like that.
With the litany of programming languages that are out there, mostly high level, what kind of programming languages do you guys look for in terms of game coders? Because I know C# is popular in teaching in colleges such as University of West Georgia and a couple other places, and it's just, should we be also investigating a lot of some lower level languages if we want to get into the game industry, or is C# and Java going to be where everything's heading to?
I think first of all, the comment that Brian made earlier about being very flexible and actually showing that you can move across languages pretty reasonably, that's a very powerful trait, at least for us when we're hiring people, because we've done stuff in the LAMP stack. We're mainly a .NET C# based shop, but we're kind of different from most of the other social gaming companies in that sense. LAMP's very, very popular. I mean, knowing C++ doesn't hurt, right? I mean, that's, if you know that as your basis, that's a great thing. But for us, yeah, it's looking and making sure the person can move across languages. And so being an expert at C# or Java or ActionScript or PHP or whatever, I mean, as long as we've seen that and they've got at least one other language, we feel comfortable they can move between when they go through our interviewing process, then we're pretty happy. So what I would do is, if you're a new programmer, focus on one language, become really good at it, and then maybe dabble in some other languages so you can at least say, I've checked them out, right? And that's probably the best answer you can give in an entry-level interview. So, and I'll say, there was one thing earlier that we were saying there, you know, I've heard a couple times now that the industry is real tough for developers. In Austin, at least in our space, social gaming space, that's not so much the case. We're always looking for resumes. It's not pitch out for you, send us a resume. You're welcome to, but the truth is that right now the Austin market's pretty hot for developers, at least in the social gaming space and casual spaces and mobile space.
Right. So. Well, yeah, but 2 years ago, we could ask a bunch of MMO developers what the market was like, and you'd get a very different response.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, I agree with the hardcore space, MMO space, it's maybe difficult.
Well, it goes in waves. I mean, you have to kind of know the market. You know, MMOs were the big thing about 5 years ago, now it's social games. It's transitioning over to mobile games, like you said. You know, if you want to break in, kind of know what's hot and what people are talking about.
Yeah, Objective-C right now is really hot for the iPhone.
Right,
market.
But you know, if you're an Atari 2600 programmer, yeah, you may be a little behind the time. So but the thing is, of course, is, you know, if you take the Atari 2600 and you use an emulator and you code up a game, that shows a level of dedication that, you know, might get you some attention, but it's not, we're not going to hire you on the basis of, wow, that was a really well put together Atari 2600 game.
For coders, I'd also like to say that we, like you mentioned, dedication and really passion for coding is something that really stands out for us. Someone who says, oh, I want to be a coder, and I say, oh, do you program? They go, no, but I'm pretty sure I could learn, or I took a few college courses. And all the coders we've hired are coders who, it doesn't matter if they're working at it or not, they're coding. They go home at night, they're coding. And that's really the kind of people that get into the game industry. It's something that it wouldn't matter if they were being paid for it or not. They'd be developing, and once you know any language really, really well, you can probably pick up other languages as well. And I want to toss this out because I have a friend in D.C. who was asking about this. There's a language called Scala, S-C-A-L-A, which is sort of like Java. It's kind of big in Europe, not so big in the United States right now, but there are these large government contractors that are desperate for Scala coders right now because they're getting contracts where they're being required to code something in Scala, but there's very few programmers in the United States that know Scala. So if you happen to know that language right now, you can write your own ticket. You want $150,000 a year entry level? Okay, they'll hire you because they already have the money.
Wait, I'm taking notes. Hold on.
So S-C-A-L-A.
It's a Java-like language. Yeah. But it won't get you in the game industry, but I'm just saying, be aware of what's hot, what's the new language out there, and there's probably people who really want that skill.
Yeah, and that's a good rule to add to this, that if you're interviewing and someone goes, oh, do you do stuff for fun as a hobby, do you program on the side or at night, always answer yes, even if you don't, okay? Because if you say no, I mean, I can almost guarantee that you're not going to be, because that means you won't reach out of your comfort zone. You won't be looking for new languages, new things, all that stuff for the company, and we look for that. And so a couple other things on the language front. I look at Unity as a very powerful platform that you should be looking at, and it's pretty rare right now to find people, and a lot of people are using it. And then, again, mobile right now is just the hottest, as Brian said, it's the hottest thing right now. So if you want to do something, work up a little Android iPhone app and just say you know how to compile and publish to a phone. And that's a good way to get in. So.
And it's a pretty cheap investment to make. You know, you pay $100 to get into the App Store for the year, get the developer license, and you can show that you've done something, even if it's just a hobby project, and gotten it out there. The only other thing I would add is make sure you know what the company you're applying to uses. And highlight that experience. If you're applying to an Android developer, don't highlight your Xcode and Objective-C iPhone development.
No, I mean, you mentioned but you know, don't say it. But you know,
this is the only thing I do.
Right. You don't want to come across as I only do iPhone development. Right. I guess I'll do some Android development if it gets me a
Android
job.
Android games suck.
But I guess I can stoop low enough to work on your stupid projects. I mean, and we're talking a lot about programmers right now, but I mean, this kind of really applies to whatever you want to do. If you're an artist, take a look at take a look at games that you like. Explain why you like it. You know, if you can, because I mean, one of the big things that an artist needs to do is be able to explain to a programmer or to a designer why certain things need to be a certain way. So you need, basically, no matter what job you get, communication skills are important. If you're a programmer, especially if you're a designer, communication is pretty much your whole entire job. If you're an artist, if you're a producer, any of those, you need to be able to communicate with other people. So focus on that. And so, as an artist, make sure that you can kind of discuss art in an intelligent way. If you want to write, the gold standard that people refer to as Neverwhere Nights. Download Neverwhere Nights. Apply yourself. Learn how to use the toolkit. It's kind of daunting for people who aren't very technical, but again, if you show that you have enough dedication to learn that, that's going to get you a lot further than somebody said. Then they just hands like a half unfinished novel and says, "No, hire me on the basis of this."
Yeah, another good tool right now is it's called Game Maker, and you can download it, and it's free, and you can be coding a game where you're like shooting at strawberries or something. But I mean, all the assets are there, and there's really no reason to not do it. You could learn how to do it in a day, and right there it gives you some experience on how to put a game together and how to set up score and a win condition, and it's wonderful experience. Where's the microphone? Sorry.
Yeah, right here. I had a question for the attorney.
No.
What's the biggest piece of advice that you give out that people ignore, that your clients ignore to their folly?
One of the big ones, one of the big ones that from a business perspective is not getting all of your business licenses and incorporation and paperwork together before you start working on the project. I've seen team after team fall apart over interpersonal drama, and then we don't have a partnership agreement. Who owns the art? Who owns this? Who owns that? So you've got all these half-finished games that no one can do anything with because the people who worked on it won't talk to each other. For people maybe more directed towards this audience and this topic, it comes to the resume review. I see teams that are desperate to get someone who can help them in an area they're weak. And what they're really looking for is cheap. And so they'll pull someone in who doesn't necessarily have any experience, and it will cost them far more money in the long run, because then you wind up going back to have to fix everything that they did wrong. So if you're trying to put together a company, make sure you really delve into someone and you really know that the person you want to go into business with has the chops, has the dedication, and has enough sense to get all of the structure in place, and understands that at the end of the day, making a game might be exciting, might be fun, might be cool, but it's a business.
I was just wondering, you guys are talking an awful lot about like code and art and design, and things like that. But I've always wondered about the musical aspect. I mean, it all started with the big Yasunori Mitsuda obsession with Chrono Trigger, and I was just wondering for like people who are into, you know, the musical aspect, how do they generally get involved? I mean, is there a particular process? I mean, what's the do's and don'ts of that?
Music is brutal. I mean, one of the things you have to consider is that, you know, music is probably one of the easiest things for, you know, if you make music for commercials, making music for games, you know, might not seem like that much of a stretch. So you basically have to compete. The competition is huge. The good news is a lot of companies do outsource, but again, you're competing with, you know, you're competing with a whole lot of other people, and, you know, I remember when I was running my own small company, I would literally get, like, a resume, per week of somebody wanting to do music for my company, and it was just, you know, it's like, you know, we didn't need that much music, and, you know, I don't know if it's any better now. I mean, that was a couple of years ago, but the other thing is that, you know, and this kind of applies to your writers too, a lot of game companies don't take music very seriously. It's like they don't take writing very seriously. So this is something that kind of happens right at the end of the project. You know, they might, you know, they'll pick up somebody who's cheap and fast, and, you know, and they kind of throw them at the project and get everything done last minute. So, you know, if you're a musician, I would recommend not doing music in the game industry, to be honest.
There are sites right now that where you can get music for free. Yeah. I can't remember any of the URLs offhand, but there's open...
There's Kevin McLeod, I think it is. He has a site where he actually does music professionally. He's got a whole bunch of tracks you can download for free and use in your game as long as you give him credit.
Right. Yeah, and there's other places where there's music that can be used under the Creative Commons license.
Right. Yeah,
so my recommendation would be to write some music for those sites, put it out there as long as you get credit. Then as soon as someone does use your music, then boom, that goes on your website. My music is used in this game.
Right.
You don't have to mention it was used for free.
Right.
But now that you have a credit that you can do, and then once you have, again, that body of work kind of established, then more people are more likely to look at you and say, oh, I really like the music that you did for this game.
Right.
Can we talk to you? It's a low probability chance of happening, but it's something to do.
Yeah, and I'll agree. I mean, Brian's right. It's brutal, brutal, brutal. I mean, every time I go to a convention and I'm talking to people, I mean, music guys are walking up to left and right giving cards and trying to pitch that way. One of the things I will say, though, and again echoing what he said, is the level of quality of writing and music and sound that goes into early studios. Like, that was a big mistake we made. Some of our first games, we went with the guy that said he'd do music for free for credits, and then we didn't do the writing. The producers did it. We didn't have a writer do it, and our game suffered because of it. I mean, our the take of the game, the quality of it. And so, you know, our second, third, and fourth games, we've actually taken that seriously and put real budget behind it and real expertise. But I think as far as just, you know, getting into the industry, if you're really dead set on it, I would look for a small studio that doesn't have a lot of budget that you can just say, hey, I want music credit. Can we do it for free? And then you can start maybe trying to get yourself some contract gigs after that. But you got to get at least one or two titles underneath your belt, I think.
Yeah. So. And some of it is just going to be luck. It's like trying to get published. Robert A. Heinlein gave a great talk about a long time ago about how to get published in a science fiction magazine. And he said, just keep sending the stories out, and you'll get rejected and rejected. But eventually, what's going to happen is some editor is going to be facing a deadline for his monthly issue. He's not going to have enough stories, and he's going to look into the slush pile, the rejected stories, and he's going to say, oh, well, I can clean up this one, I can clean up that one. So because your story was there being rejected, mean you had the opportunity to actually get included because they need something to fill the hole. So if you're writing to a company saying, I want to do music, and they just don't need music that week, that month, you know, it's going to be a waste of time. However, maybe you'll write to someone that one day when they're thinking, oh man, we need music, and boom, your email comes across their queue. So it just the lottery, luck of the draw.
So I guess I'm going to be the oddball in this group. I've actually done software and web development for a global firm. And while doing that work, I actually grew to have great respect for the people that were doing QA. And that's one of the things that I found after helping them out doing some QA, I grew to have that passion for it. And every time I've tried to apply for QA work, they look at my resume and they see C++ experience, C#, SQL, Java, ASP.NET. What are you doing applying for QA? You should be in development. I found my passion. I want to do QA work.
Sing it,
wow.
Sister. I'm a QA manager. I can't drive down the highway without spotting typos and road signs, okay?
Come up afterwards and give us your card, please.
Yeah. And I'm hiring QA interns all the time, and I hear what you're saying, because often they just want to come in as QA. They want to do QA for a month and then take off and go to design or coding or something like that. But every so often there are the oddballs where we just love QA. And I would love to see a resume like yours, someone who wants to do QA and has experience with all these technical sides. When I send out a test, and I have a test for QA as well, and it's not just about finding spelling errors. I get some really sneaky stuff in my test, but it's not just about spelling errors. We have a logic question. You know, if A is red and B is not equal to 27, what is this? And because sometimes that's what QA has to do, is they have to be able to understand the logic and see, oh, that door shouldn't be open at that point, or it should be open at that point. So I would love to have a QA. If you were in St. Louis, I'd definitely look at your resume. How's that?
And that's powerful, though, but having the programming background, I mean, I know it's weird because you're going kind of backwards down the level of, and as far as people progress.
I think QA is the most important part
is.
Of a company.
It absolutely
what are you
is.
Talking
absolutely.
About?
But it's also one of the kind of entry-level positions.
The problem is that QA in the games industry specifically has been seen as the entry-level position if you don't have, if LLOS fails, you can get a QA position, and then, and essentially a lot of game companies, they underpay the QA staff, it's terrible working conditions.
And
they're
playing the same game over and over.
Well, no, it's worse than that. It's playing the same broken game over and over again. Okay, so I mean, like a lot of companies will pitch it as, "Oh, you get to play games all day." No, it's a brutal grinding job, and the problem that I run into from QA is that most of the people getting QA, like they said, want to go into different things. So if they do a really good job at QA, it's kind of one of those things. They don't want to do too good of a job at QA because they want to move on, but they got to do a good enough job that, So, I mean, that's kind of one of the problems you run into. If you find somebody that has a passion for QA, like we had a really good guy when I was working at 3DO. He was a QA manager. He loved QA. He was good at it. That guy was golden. It's really,
Like Ilanka.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah, that's why I say that I'm kind of the oddball, because I started in development. Right. I've actually been doing development since I was 11 years old, working in BASIC and QBASIC. And then I started, once I graduated, I started working for Accenture, and they put me in software development. And once I was there, I started working side by side with this QA team that they had. It was a small QA team, and they were having me help whenever they needed help with testing. And I just absolutely loved all the detail work. And them coming back and forth and talking to me about all this code that I was writing and showing me, okay, this right here is not working with what was the specs that were needed. And I would see all these errors and the importance of their work. And I said, you know what? Thank you for making me realize that, yes, I'm important and what my work I do is important, but you catching my mistakes on what I'm doing, your work, I feel, is more important than mine.
It's tough, and I completely agree with you, and it's tough because there often is a tension between the designers and the coders and QA, because someone has designed something and they're very open to hearing all the good stuff about what they designed, and they're not very open to hearing any kind of critique. And often when QA is pointing things out that need improvement, it's not QA saying, well, your stuff sucks. It's saying, here's how our game could be better. Yeah. But it's difficult sometimes finding that balance.
Basically, that's another great tip on how to get into it. Yeah. Invest a lot of ego into your work. Don't be open to criticism. I mean, game development is 90% of the time now a team effort. So you really need to be able to work with a team. You need to obviously do the best work you can, do stuff you're passionate about, but don't be so close-minded, so narrow that you say, this is perfect, and if you suggest anything's wrong with it, I hate you forever.
Yeah, this gentleman right here in front of me said it perfectly. QA made me a better developer.
You should go to IGDA.org and look up the QA special interest group, and you'll find other people that are passionate about QA. And if you really want to work in QA, that's generally the best. Find the gathering of the people who do the thing that you want, and then talk to them. Because they'll circulate around, hey, this opening came up, do you have a friend who wants this job?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
What part of the country are you in?
I am actually in Tampa, Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, there's probably, I don't know if there's an IGDA chapter in Tampa, but I would definitely look into joining them. And as she said, join the IGDA QA SIG.
Yeah.
Okay.
Brian mentioned this earlier, offhandedly, about if you want to get into a larger company, maybe getting into a smaller company is not the best idea. Would you mind expounding on that idea?
I see this a lot. Like, we were hiring recently for the company I'm working with, Namaste, and we were talking to artists, and he's like, he's one of the guys with the Space Marine portfolio, and he's like, yeah, I really just want to work at Blizzard, but you guys will do. And you know that, and the problem is, I mean, and obviously there's good and bad things about working at a large company. I think the one of the big problems that we run into is that people kind of have a skewed idea of what it's like to work at a big company. You know, like, oh, I go work for Blizzard, I get my own corner office, you know, people will listen to me and respect me. It doesn't work like that. You know, game development's still a job at the end of the day, and a lot of times, you know, sometimes, like, especially the larger companies, they treat you a lot worse because everybody wants to work here. You know, we have the name recognition, we have the brand name, and I think that, right, yeah, oh yeah. And so I think if you want to work in the game industry, don't discount the small guys. Don't discount the indies. I mean, you know, yeah, a lot of them are kind of, some people don't take it very seriously. Some people are like, yeah, I got a great idea for a game. I just need somebody to code it for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. That, again.
Fund it, code it, try.
Yeah. Right. There's another good way not to get in the game industry. Say you're the idea guy and you want other people to help you.
Right. Yeah.
But no. But independent development, I think.
Say that again. It's really important.
Yeah. You are not the idea guy. We have somebody that does that. Either they write the checks or they've been working in the industry longer than you've been alive, probably. So, going back to what I was saying, independent development, you know, take a serious look at that. If you make a game and only 500 people play it, that's still cool. Yeah, that's still from, you know, if you think that that's not worth your time, you're in the wrong industry. Go develop bank applications or whatever, you know, something where a lot of more people are going to play it or use it but hate it. Because, you know, potentially you could grow into something larger. I mean, all the large companies were at one time small little scrappy startups, you know, Electronic Arts, Activision, all of them at one time started small. So, you know, don't discount the smaller side of things.
Right, and making a game shows not just that you've made a game, it shows that you've started a project, you've worked on the project, and you've finished a project, puts you in the top 1% of everybody that's doing anything.
Again, another way to not get hired, you know, show a dozen unfinished projects, right? Yeah, starting something's not easy, but it's so much easier than, you know, finishing it. You know, the joke I like is the last 10% takes 90% of the effort. Yeah. You know, it's so hard to finish it because, you know, with a lot of creative work, you don't know when it's never really done. You know, another great quote is, you know, a great art is so much not so much finished but as abandoned. And, you know, but being able to finish, showing that you stuck through it to the bitter end and release something, even if it's not the best thing ever, if you finish it, then show it, then do a postmortem. You know, say, hey, this is what I do differently. You know, I had this problem. Here's the cause of the problem. This is what I do differently. If you can show that level of insight, again, like I said, you're going to be in the top, like, you know, 0.1%, really.
At the Game Developers Conference, where they have so many people submitting talks each year, it's very hard to get a talk accepted, but one type of talk that they really love is the postmortems. Someone who shipped a game and then is doing a 2020 look at what was it like making it, what was the context of the industry, what did they do right, what did they do wrong. Those postmortems every year is one of the most valuable kind of talks there.
What kind of place do infrastructure personnel, like IT personnel, security personnel, etc.? My own particular specialty is network engineering. I cover IT, hardware, purchasing and selling of software, maintaining of hardware and software, and of course security accounts and confidentiality security. What kind of place does that have in the gaming industry, both small and large?
I guess I'll start with that. It's funny that you mentioned that. So we in social gaming, they're live games, just like MMOs. So there's a lot of back end server management, and the thing there is that most of it's in the cloud at this point, right? And I hate even saying that word now, because an investor friend of mine last night was going, everyone I'm talking to now, like, says in the cloud at the end of everything they say, like, it's the best idea ever to have something in the cloud, like,
and so. Somebody else's
room. Right, exactly. Yeah. So what I would say to that point, though, is that you want to make sure that you do have experience with Amazon or Azure or something like that. That's a really good thing to have, because if we're hiring, we're not big enough yet. We got 23 employees, so we wouldn't have a full-time IT person yet. But once we get to that point, we would be we'd be looking for someone with at least cloud management experience, as well as someone that can help around, you know, with the local network infrastructure and everything else. So I think you need to look for a company that's large enough to support an IT person, because there's a kind of a critical mass you get to. Like, that'll be one of our next hires probably in the next, you know, 5 or 10 employees. But that would be my only advice.
You made a good point that apparently the first companies to look for infrastructure is casual and MMOs.
Yeah,
oh, absolutely. Yeah, MMOs especially. You know, yeah, we need good infrastructure people. But you know, even then, I mean, you know, it's kind of a question of, you know, having specific skills. You know, one of the big problems we run into is the skills. The network design required for an MMO is radically different than the networking design you need for supporting a website, for example. Because, you know, a lot of things that, you know, you care about in the MMO, you don't care about so much. You know, if somebody waits a second for a web page, not optimal, but they'll still come, you know, still come around. Waiting a second for your game to update, even though Meridian 59 did that, but that it was written for 14.4K modem, so not so cool anymore. So, you know, basically the design and architecture needs to be very different. I think if you... Right, exactly. And so I think, you know, in that case, you need to show that, yes, I'm aware of the differences in like Aaron said before, you know, it's the same thing. Go to a place where people are passionate about it. You know, network and operations tends to not get a lot of the press, but there are some really good people that, you know, basically talk a lot about it. And, you know, when you find a good person, you know, you really want to hold, again, it's one of those things, it's pretty much true for every position, but once you find a good operation person, you want to hold on for them as long as possible, because if they understand your specific needs, you know, it's a lot better than, you know, than outsourcing to somebody who, you know, is used to doing websites or whatnot. You know,
finding someone experienced in the game industry that's really good at scalable architecture on that side is really, really hard. And so if you can get in there, even with a small company, medium-sized company, or large company, and get that experience for a year or two, tremendously valuable. So
yeah, there's an interesting thing happening, especially in social now, that where the companies that are starting up and there's a lot of money, a lot of business in it, are pulling from, you can get a job at Cisco, Google, Microsoft, and hang out there for a year and then come out with that experience. Oh, sorry. That's what people are looking for on resumes, so there's a lot more cross-pollination that's happening now than there ever used to be. And I think actually that applies to artists as well. If you can do an internship at Disney or Pixar, that's going to count for a lot more than it used to. So.
Okay, I was curious as to what you thought about game design degrees versus more straightforward programming degrees, and also how many game design degrees you're seeing in your applications.
Yeah, I was actually going to add, thank you for asking that question, because I was going to ask kind of people what you guys thought about the different game design schools, ranging from Full Sail to SCAD to Sanford Brown and ITT. Well, I have my own opinion. I didn't know if you guys want to.
I think it doesn't matter. We see a lot of applications from that. Some of them are very good, some of them are not. The number one thing that's the greater indicator on top of that is if you've had a game in the IGF.
Independent Game Festival.
Yeah, right. If you can go to school, SCAD has a great showing at IGF every year.
That's so Savannah College of Art and Design.
Sorry, okay. And Carnegie Mellon does as well. So
I'm her translator.
I'm just going to spout acronyms. But it's actually showing execution that's going to be the differentiators. The problem with those game design degrees is they can be a lot of nothing, depending on what you do when you're there. So you really have to show something that's great. And if you can meet people, the hard thing as well when you're in college is sorting through the people that are for real and not. You know, it's unfortunately true. And if you can find people that are as passionate as you are, as passionate about actually getting a finished product that's excellent, that can be a great place to do it. So they can be a great advantage, or they can be, it's kind of a dice roll.
For myself, some of the technical schools, ITT and Sanford Brown. We have hired people from ITT and Sanford Brown, both. However, I found that the degree that they get from the schools really don't matter. If someone's a good designer, they probably were a good designer when they started ITT, and then when they come out of ITT, they're still a good designer, and the skills that they got, they may have gotten some stuff to kind of round out their skill set. But then again, I like working with ITT because I say, hey, I need 25 testers for a new game we're doing, and ITT will probably give us a big, you know, bus, not literally, but a ton of people are going to come in the door, and so it's a quick way to get a hold of people. Generally, if someone's saying, should I go to ITT, should I go to Sanford Brown or one of these schools, my answer, quite honestly, is going to be no. If you have that much money, go to an accredited university, and you can probably get a better education for less money.
Well, my perspective is, not to say there's not some good graduates and whatnot, but as we kind of said before, the game industry is not exactly the kindest place, and it kind of tends to chew up and spit people out. If you have a more general degree, you're going to be able to land on your feet a lot better than if you have a very specialized game design degree, if you decide the game industry is not for you. So, I mean, I have a degree in computer science, I have a degree in Spanish. Don't ask. it seemed like a good idea at the time. If the game industry had not been what I wanted to do long term, I could have gotten another job. In two completely unrelated fields. I think that's important. Especially from the game design point of view, but this applies really to everything. The more well-rounded you are, the better you are. Basically, game developers tend to be very intelligent, very curious people. It kind of goes back to what I said before. If you specialize too much, you're going to stand out and not in a good way. Going to a more general university and picking up, I love electives. I took classes on Japanese history, Chinese history, linguistics. I took all sorts of things. And, I may not have similar opportunities if I went to a more specialist, essentially trade school for game design. So I think, I definitely would recommend getting a university degree. And my preference would be, as far as hiring goes, I'll look at the candidate. But for your personal satisfaction and long-term health, I'd say go for a more general degree. That way, if the games industry is not for you, you can do something else besides, getting low-paying QA jobs where people don't respect you.
Yeah. And I'll start out by saying I'm kind of the opposite. I didn't end up getting my degree. Self-taught myself programming. Did a lot of reading, a lot of learning from other programmers and management people as I moved into management. And so I'm not encouraging anyone to do that because it's a really tough market across the board now. So getting a degree is something I wish I would have done, but just lucked out. And so, but we have hired a lot of people from Full Sail, and it's I think that it's not a bad thing to have that on your resume. I mean, having any degree on your resume is a good thing. And I agree though, if you decide that the game industry is not for you, it's kind of a useless degree, right? And so I would say that going to a general school is better. But what Aaron said was absolutely right. The most important thing, I think, is whatever school you're in, get in a group, build a game, with students that you feel passionate about, they feel passionate about, find the right group. If it's not the right group, move on, find another one, build multiple games. That helps a lot. I mean, we look at those things when we interview people. So, yeah.
With some schools, when I'm reviewing resume, whether or not someone has a degree means practically nothing to me. But not all companies are that way. Some companies, you have to have a degree in something in order to get a job at the company. Certain schools that will make me take a second look, like, okay, well, I'm sort of interested in that. SCAD is one of them. Because they make things at SCAD. The graduates that come out of SCAD are really, really good at what they do. Full Sail, often it'll help, but it's a little bit like the technical school. Some of the Full Sail students I've seen have been really, really good. They've come out, and I've also seen some poor students come out of Full Sail. But one thing about Full Sail that I really, really like is that they focus on someone's ability to work in a team. So they ask all the students to rate themselves on what are my strong points as a person? What are my weak points as a person? And rate other people in the team, because working in a team, especially high pressure, you got a deadline, you got egos involved, it's a highly creative process. Being able to work as part of a team in that kind of environment is so important in the game industry.
Absolutely.
I mean, crunching is something that happens. And Erin can talk. I mean, she's EA spouse. She's the one that wrote that blog. Just that kind of environment, unfortunately, is still part of the industry.
Yeah, and you asked about design or development. I would say if you're making a choice between the two, development is probably the better, safer bet.
Like I said, I have a degree in computer science, but I've been moving slowly more into more and more design. So, I mean, if you're a competent designer, it doesn't matter kind of where you start. You'll probably eventually gravitate toward there.
Yeah.
Your degree, your title in the school is not what's going to get you a job. It's going to be your portfolio. That said, if you go to a school and you work in one of these teams and people remember that you were a good teammate, being in the design or the game design or development school means you're going to have contacts in the industry. And the next best thing to being in the right place at the right time is having a buddy who is at the right place at the right time.
Amen.
That's true.
Yeah, Facebook. Who is this person friends with? Oh, look, we have friends in common. Bing, that's a plus.
Yeah, right? That's good.
I was wondering, for QA, is there a way to prepare a portfolio of any kind, or how do you get into a job with QA exactly?
Well, first you want to send a cover letter where everything is properly spelled and punctuated, where the grammar is correct, where the company name is spelled properly. And generally, there's a lot of entry-level positions in QA. So when people have written to me and I have sent them a test and it was just horrible, and I wrote it, often if it's horrible, I just won't write back to them. But sometimes they write back and say, how'd I do? And I'm like, God, I have to tell them. And my honest advice to them will be to take a class in writing, in English, in spelling. Get those things right. Because if you cannot write an English sentence, you're probably not going to get a job in QA, depending on how desperate someone is. Some companies, when they say QA, they mean someone who's going to just be pushing the buttons and seeing can the character run through walls or not. So you don't need to be able to spell. You just need to be able to play the same level over and over and over again.
For your portfolio, you might want to include like maybe 100 recipes on how to cook ramen noodles. That shows that you're thinking in the right pay grade.
For a small company, having a tech support background, like not necessarily, you know, first tier, but second tier, where you're actually having to go through, deal with customers and solve problems, shows that you know how to approach technical issues and figure out what's going wrong.
Yeah. And I'll say in any cover letter, just some advice in the game industry specifically, I think, saying you have a passion for whatever X is. I have a passion for art. I have a passion for great game art, passion for QA, passion for development. That's really good, except for the rule that we've already talked about, game design, right? Don't pitch yourself as a game designer if that's your first job in the space, right? Because then, I mean, I'll look at that and go, they want to be a game designer. We probably can't get them there for a couple of years. It's not the right fit for us, and I'll actually move on from their resume. It's unfair or not. It's just we know that, you know, people get into a position if they're that passionate about it, they can't embrace the position that they get hired for. So I wouldn't hire a person that says that for a QA position because I know they're not passionate about QA, they're after something else. So
is it bad to say that your eventual goal would be a designer?
I don't think necessarily hide it, but
I'm interested in learning QA because I think it'll make me a better designer eventually. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Saying, I'll stoop low enough to do QA until you finally recognize my genius as a designer.
You've now insulted me. Okay, yeah. Good job.
Right.
Okay. Also something we haven't really covered in terms of how to get into the game industry is where to look. When I'm looking for interns, first place I'm going to go is Craigslist, and I'm going to post an ad, and I'm going to see who writes back. And like I said, most of the cover letters are going to be very poor. Some people just send a resume with no cover letter at all, and that's usually an instant no, because I can tell they're just spamming every ad they see. Also, find out if there's an IGDA chapter in your area. Also go to meetup.com, and there's probably some sort of a game developer meetup in your area. And find out where are they meeting, and meet people. Is there a Yahoo group mailing list for the game industry in your area? So, and find out if anyone needs help testing on anything. It might not be specifically for QA. They may just say, hey, we have a new game. We want 5 people to come in and play it. Go do it, even though it's not a specific job, because it gets you in the door. It lets you network with people. And we have hired people simply because they were really good. One time, they came in, they tested a game, they filled out a questionnaire, they left, and I look at the questionnaire and went, whoa, I'm going to write back to this person and see, are they, you know, would they be interested in an intern position?
One other kind of related topic, probably good to mention too, would be recruiters. People have kind of different opinions about recruiters. I actually got my first job in the industry through a recruiter, so I had a very good experience with it. Then I tried to get my second job through a recruiter, and I had a very poor experience because I was applying for one company, and the recruiter had contacts in kind of the parent company, so I said, oh, I'll send your resume to the parent company. And then, so another company that wasn't very interested in contacted me, oh, hey, we're looking for a developer, well, that's nice. I kind of want to do online stuff, and you guys are definitely not an online company. So, I mean, the most important thing, however, I think it's a little less common now, but you know, it's kind of the same advice that if you go to the writing track, they'll tell you, the flow of money goes from the recruiter to you. You do not pay the recruiter to find a job for you. You know, proper recruiters make their money by taking a cut of, you know, however much you make when
you
get hired.
Signing bonus, right? Or something. Yeah.
Right. They take that cut. They get paid by the game company. You do not pay them. And so that's, you know, again, you know, working with a recruiter can be really useful. Just keep in mind, of course, that some companies are going to have a bias against working with recruiters, especially an entry-level position. It's going to be really tough. You know, like I said, I'm a programmer. I have a degree in computer science. My first job in the industry was as a programmer. I made pretty decent money. Actually, the recruiter said that I got a higher salary than she was expecting, so she's very pleased with me. But you need to be very careful, though. Just, you know, make sure that, you know, talk to the recruiter. You know, get feedback from him or her. You know, get, you know, basically they can be a really good ally, but make sure that they're working for you. Make sure your, you know, your interests should be fairly aligned. But, you know, make sure the recruiter's not just pawning you off on a quick job to, you know, to you know, get a quick turnaround.
And if you use a recruiter, there is the they're probably gonna be targeting larger companies, but also interview them, ask them if they've actually worked with any game companies in the past or have any contacts there.
Right.
Because there's plenty of them out there that don't, and there's some that are really good at that. So.
Yeah, I advise people. They were at a conference, and there were a bunch of recruiters in a sort of a job fair area, and the person I was talking to wanted to get in the MMO industry and weren't sure which recruiter to work with. And I said, go to recruiter and say, hey, who are the three biggest MMO companies? And if the recruiter cannot answer that question, move on to the next booth. Yeah. Or if they can't answer, say, oh, who's your contact at EA? Now, they may choose not to answer, but you can probably get a sense of, you know, how are their contacts? Yeah. Do they know? Right. So, yeah, interview the recruiter.
There's lots of recruiters out there. So, no offense to recruiters, but there's a lot of them. And if you don't get a good feeling, go call someone else.
Right. So. There's a book written by a recruiter, Mark Mensher, who's at GameRecruiter.com. He wrote a book called Get in the Game or Get into the Game, which is it's a pretty good book. I recommend it.
Two questions, really. The first, how important is your current location to looking to enter the gaming industry, and how valuable would you be getting experience if you're looking to move upward as a bottom level tester?
So, location, I'll answer that, because actually I had a good friend of mine. He lived in Mississippi. He's like, I would like to get a job and work in the game industry. I said, okay, number one, move.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, you're not going to find a serious game developer in Mississippi. And, you know, he was lucky where he was able to move to Austin pretty quick, easily.
Austin.
And, basically, you know, especially if you're entry level, if you're not, you know, you're not somebody who can give John Carmack a run for the money in a programming contest, you're probably going to have to move. And, I mean, the unfortunate parts of the industry is it's really hard to set down permanent roots. You know, I've been renting for the past, you know, for as long as I've been in the industry, just because I don't know where I'm going to have to move. That's just kind of the reality you have to face. So there's a couple of big locations for game development. Austin is a big one. You know, basically a lot of the companies on the coast. You know, there's Boston is a big one. San Francisco, Seattle.
San Diego.
I mean, you know, your chances, it's not impossible to get a job in the smaller industries. You know, there might be some small independent, you know, I originally grew up in Iowa, actually, but, you know, and I've talked to a couple of independent developers that, you know, that set up shop in Des Moines. So, I mean, it's not impossible for you to get a job, but, you know, your chances are going to improve significantly, because most companies are probably not going to want to pay relocation fees for an entry-level position.
No company is going to pay relocation fees for an entry-level position.
We've got some fantastic resumes, and I look, and they live in another state, and I'm saying, I'm sorry, you'd be a perfect fit, but no.
Yeah, and if it's not possible to move ahead of time, though, and you want to send out resumes to other cities and you're willing to move, then put that in your cover letter.
Right.
Say, look, I know, you know, I'm out, not in Austin or whatever, but I'll be willing to move myself.
Right.
And that'll get me a phone interview with me at least. So.
I have a.
All right, there we go. I have a real passion. I'm using your words for storyline, character development, and depth of the world that video games like to create. And while I do know that the video game industry can suffer in those areas, because the gaming industry thinks of success in terms of monetary gain, and sometimes, in my opinion, success is the story. So, like, Far Cry 2, no story whatsoever. Throw away protagonists, throw away secondary characters, no story whatsoever. Did really well because of the gameplay. Armored Core 4, you don't even know what year it is when you're playing. So I have a big passion in storyline and getting the story to be the upfront in the game design. Start with the story, start with the game mechanics, and then work from there. And normally story is just tacked on at the very end. How can we, as people who are trying to get into the industry, make some kind of impact to where we can see our industry and our love change into something better?
So tomorrow, 11:30, there's actually a panel on the writer's track about writing in the games industry. So this, you'd probably want to go. You know, my snarky comment is this is not the writer's track. And I mean, the unfortunate reality is exactly what you said. A game that plays well with a crap story still sells. A game that plays crap but still has a great story doesn't sell. I mean, you know, and I appreciate your passion. I like to write as a hobby. And the current project I'm working on is called Storybricks. You know, obviously we want to allow people to tell stories within the context of a game. But, I mean, it's really, you know, you as an individual are not going to convince people of that. And, you know, and at the end of the day, it's kind of what you said. You know, yeah, games measure themselves on financial success. They're a business. So, I mean, you know, they will do what they see as being important for financial success. And you occasionally have kind of the mavericks that want to go out there and do something new and interesting and, you know, try to tell, you know, like, you know, bring more storytelling. Obviously, this has worked very well for some companies like Blizzard or, you know, like a Valve with the Half-Life series has been very, very focused on story. But those, you know, as you probably well know, those are the aberrations. Those are the exceptions that kind of prove the rule, unfortunately. So,
yeah, I would say, I mean, to be really good at writing in the game industry, I mean, you want to make sure that you can write good stories within the context of the making money part, and then you work from internal in the studio with trying to push the idea of a good story into the game without breaking the make money model, right? So, and I mean, that's again, that was one of the lessons we learned in the social gaming space, how important the writing was and the story elements, or we believe at least, and we'll see. So.
And you might want to get a job, say, as part of a smaller part of a larger project where you're designing levels or designing, you know, some smaller part of the game where they really need someone, and just kind of keep your ears open for, you know, are the writers to getting together? What are they talking about? And maybe ask if you can sit in on a meeting. It really depends on how large the company is.
Yeah.
Some smaller companies where everybody's wearing a lot of hats and everybody's doing a lot of different things, having someone who's just focused on story might not be, you know, very appealing to them. But a very large company with a very large budget, and they may have people who are just writing, and you might want to find some other part of that company to get into and then see if you can kind of migrate over to the writing side.
Does the writer have anything to contribute to write?
Yeah, it's such a complicated question. I would actually say if you really deeply care about story, you have to go where the story is, which is in writing. It's in Hollywood, and you can do that on your own time. You can do screenwriting. Interactive story is still so fascinating and unproven and advancing, and you have to think about story in a very different way. You have to think about it symbolically and the difference between writing and story. Because, for instance, if you handed even like George R.R. Martin, he's a little bit different because he actually is interested in wargaming and whatnot, but and said make a game, a lot of writers and people that are really good at story cannot make good games because they're not thinking symbolically, they're not thinking about the story emerging from the actions of the player. So there's a lot of experimentation that you can do and start thinking about story in the most concise way possible. What are the fewest number of cues that you can give someone and create a world in their mind? So it's a radically different thing than either writing or games. And you have to pursue it on your own and try not to get angry at the industry for being the way it is.
Yeah.
that's true no matter what, though.
Yeah. You have both, because there are some shining examples of some great story. The Half-Life series, and Amnesia: The Dark Descent, I highly recommend it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Assassin's Creed has some good stuff. They put a lot of work into it.
I mean, I think the big problem is just that, you know, the game industry tends to be very conservative in how they grow. And so, you know, like Aaron said, you know, a lot of the interesting storytelling is happening outside. You know, the other thing that's, you know, is basically, you know, get together the team that's as passionate as you are and try to make a small game where you really focus on that. I mean, like I said, with what we're working on with the Storybricks, you know, we've started really looking at
how can you tell a story? You know, like, you know, we're looking at things like animation and how it touches a lot of other things. I mean, I think if you have a passion for that, start expanding as much as possible. You know, learn, you know, essentially you're gonna want to, you know, learn programming, learn art, learn animation. You're kind of going to be, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, this is kind of also the same way you grow into being a kind of a senior designer. You need to know a little bit of everything. I think that's where we're going to see storytelling be pushed forward, really, is, you know, as we have people that are kind of interested in that. And I think there are other people that are passionate about story. It's just, you know, essentially making the business case. And, you know, if you can do that outside the construct of, you know, outside the restrictions of having to make money, if you can make your own game on your own time and kind of show how, you know, kind of take the first fumbling steps, that might be good. But, you know, trying to go to Activision and say, no, you must put story forefront, and
yeah, this actually gets into, I think, another how not to get into the game industry, which is to say, I have this 500,000 page thing that I must make, and it's the only thing that I'm passionate about, or I want to do the most ultimate Peter Molyneux thing, and I want someone to give me $50 million to do it, or my ideas, I'm not even aware of how expensive my ideas are.
Right.
So if you instead can go to a company and look at their game and say, what is the smallest single thing you can do to radically improve story in that experience, it's much more relevant to them, and try and find the smallest step forward that makes the biggest difference, and that can take you a long way.
Yeah.
I think Brian mentioned Neverwinter Nights Toolkit earlier, but that's if you're going to do something on your own, even if you don't get a group together or whatever, that's a good one where you can put a lot of story and dialogue into it as well.
Right. So. Yeah, actually, for BioWare, if you apply to be a writer at BioWare, that's what they require you to do. They want you to write a module in Neverwinter Nights. So, you know, just go in there, learn it, and, you know, hey, you never know, maybe you can apply to BioWare. I mean, like, you know, like you said, that they're the one that the groups that's kind of pushing story to the forefront. So maybe that's a good way. Maybe that's your doorway into the industry if you think that could help. So.
Yeah, and it bears repeating, you know, it's business. Yes, they want to make money. If you're trying to get into this, show that you can be passionate about what you think are the principles and priorities while working within a business framework. Show that you can meet a deadline. Show that you can organize your plot lines so that someone else can pick up and handle writing this chapter from your notes. Some of the stuff I've seen people get hired is they just have a blog where they post a chapter, and they post a chapter every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so they've shown that for 6 months they've hit this deadline, and they can turn in 2,000 words three times a week.
Yeah, someone asked about being QA. Blog. Yeah, blog. Yeah, regularly show that you're reliable. All those things are
good.
We
won't talk about how reliable my blog is anymore.
I think we're at time.
I was wondering what your thoughts were on the recent rise of digital distribution and the indie developers.
Actually, we had to talk about this in the last panel, right before this. No, digital distribution is a really great thing. But it's one of those things, kind of a love-hate relationship, because it gives you a lot more opportunities, but it also puts a lot more demands on you. Like, basically, the person asking the question was complaining about, like, Steam and how when they first started playing Half-Life 2, you know, Steam consumed so many resources on their computer. And, you know, so you kind of have people who have, you know, the players have a love-hate relationship with it, and developers, again, we have a love-hate relationship with it, but pretty much down the line, pretty much every indie developer that's gotten on Steam has said, this is such a life-changing event. You know, my game gets into, you know, not only am I selling more copies, I'm making more money, I get, you know, get the game out there further. You know, if you're an indie developer, definitely look at, you know, get into as many distribution channels as possible. And, you know, and down the line, you know, even if you decide that indie development isn't your thing, having a game out there that was on Steam, yeah, that gets you to kind of the top of the resume pile.
Steam, Xbox Live, iPhone, Android,
Yeah, the great thing is it lowers the barrier to entry for people, makes it much easier to get a game out there. The downside is it lowers the barrier to entry for people, so there's a lot of crap out there, and you've got to wade through that noise, and you've got to make yourself heard through all of that.
Yeah, right now, iPhone apps per day, 600 new apps are submitted per day. Now, not all of those are games, but there's just a lot of stuff going on out there.
There's a lot of noise that you have to make cut through.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
Several of you have mentioned location as a factor, that there are specific locations that are good for games, and that matters where you are. But in other industries, there's been much more of a movement now toward telecommuting and virtual positions. Is that not happening in the game industry? And if not, why not?
Somewhat. I mean, I'm a good example because at one point I was contracting to a German company that's outsourcing the programming to China. So, I mean, outsourcing happens, you know, telecommuting happens. The big problem you have is that there's still some value in, because it's a very creative, and you have a lot of, you know, you have a lot of discussions. Face to face is so much better than any other medium for communicating. You can do communication, but I think the important thing is that, the company I'm working with right now, most of the developers are over in London. I took 2 weeks. I went out to London. And I spent a lot of face to face time with the guys, and that way we kind of established that communication, the rapport, and then I was able to work from remotely. So I think that, you know, the problem is, of course, is, you know, when I started with this company, I had 13 years of experience in the industry. For a new person trying to break in, you know, you don't have that weight of history behind you. I can do it a lot easier just because, you know, but my first job, like I said, I grew up in Iowa. I was working in Eastern Iowa. My first job, I moved over to California. There's no way I was going to be able to do, especially something like programming. And this, the restrictions get looser as you kind of go to a smaller company, as you get to a smaller independent. I mean, if you're doing your own thing and you've got like 4 or 5 people, it doesn't really matter where you are. You know, as long as you kind of, you know, as long as you can coordinate. The thing is, though, is communication is paramount. You need to be communicating. You need to, you know, get Skype. You use the IM. Use voice on a constant basis. If you're not making, you know, voice calls at least every week, you're doing it wrong. If you're not chatting with everybody pretty much on a daily basis, you're doing it wrong. You know, you can replace face-to-face, but it's a lot more work. And for a lot of larger companies, it's not worth it.
And it also depends, like, how much money do you want to be making? Is this a full-time job? Is this a part-time job? Remote work can work. I mean, right here. I mean, he was a remote contractor. He worked for me for years, and we'd never actually met. I think here at DragonCon was, or SimuCon was probably the first time that we met. And there is a lot of remote work out there, not necessarily in the game industry, but you can go to a site like Guru.com or Elancer.com or Odesk.com, where there's constantly people saying, I need something to do X, and you sign up and say, hey, I can do X, and you get together and you can do the work. But it's you're constantly going to be doing the legwork for your next job. Contracting can work, can be lucrative, but there's a fair amount of time overhead involved with making it work.
Yeah, and I would say that, I mean, getting into the industry, I mean, really this goes with any industry, even outside gaming. I mean, trying to get a full-time telecommute position right out the gate, it's very, very difficult, and it's just lucky if you get it. And so
now, and you know, as you know, somebody, you know, I'll just echo what Alonka said. You know, I made a lot of money consulting, but I also spent a lot of time not working because I was trying to land the next gig. Right. The other problem I ran into was one of my jobs. Things weren't going so well, so they played the blame the contractor game. And so, yeah, I thought things were going great. All of a sudden, you know, basically they were getting pressure from the outside influence, and they went, oh, things aren't going up. It's the contractor's fault. We'll fire him, and everything will be fine. Everything, of course, wasn't fine because I wasn't I'd like to believe I wasn't the problem, I guess. But, you know, it's a very precarious situation to be in, and especially for your first entry-level job. You know, I think, you know, relocating, and if you can't relocate, then, you know, do what you can, but it can be really tough.
Yeah, on a project team, yeah, finger pointing always goes to the guys not in the office first, right? It's really weird.
This is an artist question. Okay, I use certain applications that aren't necessarily the majority. Like I do 3D modeling, and it's basically my 3ds Max and all that. But I use another application. I was wondering, what's the likelihood of getting work with another application if you do it better? Necessarily, like, you could export those models as OBJs, and basically, I know both applications, but I'd rather work in another application to save time necessarily. So I was wondering, is there like a way to get hired using another application if you do better at it?
You got to be prepared to use the tools that the company has, especially entry-level position. If you get in and you say, boy, you want me to do, you know, 27 models, I can do it in 3D Studio Max, but man, you know, if you guys were willing to spend, whatever, $100, $5 or whatever for this other set of tools, I could do this in half the time. Yeah. You might have a boss who would be willing to right. do that. But,
The big thing is, and make sure you're not putting additional work. You know, if it's, well, you can export it to that, but I'm going to need a couple hours of programmer time. No, deal killer. I mean, you know, basically, you know, the other thing is, of course, is with the kind of desktop support, IT support, you know, if you're bringing in another kind of weird programmer that they're going to have to support, you know, if you have, you know, if there's some conflict, you know, IT is either going to hate you forever or make you do your own troubleshooting. So, you know, be prepared for that aspect. I'd say, especially for entry level, you know, kind of suck it up and you know, do work with the tools that they want you to work with. I mean, and it's one of those things that, you know, you'll probably get better with it, but don't be afraid to, like what Lanka said, say, you know, if you get to the point, say, hey, look, there's this other tool I'm really comfortable with, maybe you could look at it, you know, just realize that there's potentially going to be repercussions. And if you do, like, pimping indies again. If you work with an indie company, they probably won't care what you get, what you use.
Yeah. You know, you want to go home and do it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If you use, you know, Paint and a hex editor to make 3D models, you know, whatever. As long as I get what I need and you know. So if you're really kind of tired of that tool and you think you can really do it, you might want to look at that. You know, kind of go to, you know, like we've said before, go to some of the, you know, the gathering places, IGDA, or go to places where they talk about indie developers talking. Say, hey, look, I can make 3D models. I can export to these formats. If anybody's interested, let's talk.
It's just interesting. In the industry, a few years ago, it used to be companies just couldn't get enough 3D artists. If you had 3D skills, boom, you were hired. And these days, I would say that it's cycled, and now it's more about 2D art, because mobile apps and social apps.
Generally, I was going to say, look, when you're applying and trying to get in the company, you want to reduce risk for that company, right? You want to make it as easy as possible for them to say yes about bringing you on. That means, making it easy for you. Get in there, be productive, and them not going, gosh, I wonder if these tools really work or he really knows what he's talking about or whatever, right? So I would say that, like they've said, I mean, you got to use the tools that they're using and really say, or at least say, I can do those, you know, and I'm willing to do those. So
any company you apply for, they're going to have their own challenges. I'm 100% agreement with what he said. So when you're talking to someone who's making the decision on whether to hire, think they've got problems. What can I do to help them solve their problems? They're not there to help you solve your problem about not having a job. They don't care about that. They care about their own problems. So if you can help them with that, then you're more likely to get hired.
Yeah. I think we need to wrap.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I think we need to wrap up at this point.
Yeah.
Thank you all for coming.
Great. Thank you. Great audience. Good question.